Australia in the World is a podcast produced with the support of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. The AAA wants Australians to know, understand and engage more in international affairs. All views expressed are solely those of the speakers themselves. Hello and welcome back to the Australia in the World podcast. As always, you're with Darren Lim from the Australian National University. And it has been a big week to 10 days in Australian foreign policy because we have just finished hosting a summit in Melbourne, the ASEAN Australia Special Summit, which commemorates 50 years of dialogue relations between Australia and the ASEAN organisation. And so this isn't exactly an emergency episode, but it is a bit of a last minute one because I have joining me on the line Stephen Jedgetts of the ABC. Stephen, welcome back.
Hi, Darren. Great to be back.
And of course, you've just spent the week following events down in Melbourne and back here in Canberra over the past few days. So look, to try and set the scene for our listeners, if you'd been living under a rock for the past 2 weeks and haven't been paying attention to the news, I would say there are probably five big newsworthy things that have come out of this frenetic period of diplomacy, which saw most of the ASEAN leaders coming to Australia, meeting with the Prime Minister, meeting with each other, talking about all the big issues of the day. And those five big facts are, one, the very fact that the summit happened itself down in Melbourne, which resulted in the Melbourne Declaration joint statement. Number two, Australia's announcement of the Southeast Asia Investment Financing Facility, I guess we'll call it SIFE, which is a new development policy tool that we'll be using to engage with the region. Third, the conclusion of a comprehensive strategic partnership with Vietnam that was formed between the two prime ministers in Canberra this week. Fourth, some differences of opinion, maybe I won't call them disagreements, but some expressed differences of opinion about China from within ASEAN, particularly by the leaders of the Philippines and Malaysia. And then fifth and finally, some pretty strident public comments, at least from the Malaysian prime minister on the West's position on the Israel's counteroffensive in Gaza. Stephen, would you agree that they're probably the five big sources of news that are worth potentially discussing today?
Yeah, I would, Darren. I think that's a pretty neat summary of the big main themes that have come out this week. Obviously, there are lots of other bits and pieces, but I think that's a pretty good place to start.
Excellent. Well, the first thing I wanted to observe, and I'm curious if you have a reaction to this, is that I've always extolled the virtues of Australia's China debate, as toxic and, you know, unpleasant as it can be from time to time, in that it's very open, right? You see people from all sides airing their opinions and grievances, sometimes on a personal level, but it's very much there for the rest of the world to see. You know, it's a function of our liberal open society, of free speech. And in many ways, I'd like to think of that as aiding the rest of the world in understanding the issues because we can talk about them so forthrightly. I just wondered this week, we saw some ASEAN leaders with some pretty strong statements, you know, on China, on the Gazan conflict. And I wondered, is this the kind of thing that we would have seen in an ASEAN summit held in a regional capital? Or would the leaders have traditionally been more deferential, unwilling to rock the boat? But here in Australia, they can kind of criticize or talk to us because we're a little bit outside the tent, but in a way, therefore, speak maybe a bit more forthrightly than we might otherwise expect. Would you agree with that sense?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's probably a little bit around the margins, but I think it's true that it's one thing having an ASEAN Australian Leaders Summit and another having a full of ASEAN Leaders Summit in an ASEAN country. The sensitivities of the chair nation in particular are always going to be front of mind. Now, of course, Australia and Laos were notionally co-hosting this, but it was largely, in reality, Australia's show. And whilst Southeast Asian leaders are not indifferent to Australian sensitivities, they're probably at least sometimes a little bit more, they might feel at times a little bit more free and easy. And certainly when it comes to Gaza, I think quite comfortable about being pretty critical. Now, that's within limits, of course. No one's expecting Southeast Asian leaders to come out and lambast Australia in public. Even Anwar Ibrahim, the most critical of all of the ASEAN leaders, was careful, both at the ANU and to some degree at the summit itself, to watch some of his language, to check exactly what he said and to caveat it where necessary. But I think broadly speaking, yes, I think the atmosphere in Australia probably is just a little bit more liberal and open in a sense, even within the confines of the summit.
All right, well, let's start with this notion that it was Australia's show. What were Australia's goals this week, do you think, and were they achieved?
I mean, Australia's main goal, I think, is pretty much what they've said. They, one, wanted to demonstrate to Southeast Asian leaders that they were serious about stepping up Australia's presence in the region, particularly its commercial presence, and two, unveil a series of announcements that would convince Southeast Asian leaders that that was the case. And that's what we saw today and this week with the announcements across the infrastructure space, across the business space, across the investment space. All of this was a pretty concerted diplomatic effort to try and convince Southeast Asian leaders that Australia was serious. We can have a discussion later about what these mechanisms are, what these new initiatives are, how effective they may or may not be. But at least in the first instance, that was a pretty important bit of signalling. The second thing is that they wanted to have a conversation about, you know, some of those more fraught strategic questions in the region. There was understandably and unsurprisingly a big focus on maritime security, with more than one eye kept very firmly on events in the South China Sea. And of course, we got another demonstration of that, as you know, this week with yet another confrontation as the summit rolled on in the South China Sea between the Philippines and the Chinese. Two of their Coast Guard vessels bumping up against one another, the Chinese turning a water cannon on the Philippines vessel. Now, I think Australia was pretty realistic about exactly what it was going to achieve on this front. The session at the beginning, when Penny Wong set the tone with a fairly forceful speech, at least by ASEAN standards, on events in the maritime security space, was sort of a tacit recognition that there was only so far Australia would be able to nudge ASEAN to putting any sort of concerted or meaningful pressure on China. I think Australia is realistic about what ASEAN is willing to do and can do in this space. But that was nonetheless, I think, at the core of Australian diplomacy, to see if there was an attempt to nudge ASEAN to be a little bit more courageous, but also a little bit more creative about coming up with solutions to try and enforce some sort of norms in the region and particularly in the South China Sea.
Before we get to the substance of some of this policy and these issues that were discussed, I'm interested in the sort of the distinction between form and substance, right? You've talked about how we've wanted to demonstrate credibly some concrete commitments and engagement with the region. But I was struck that when the Philippines president, Marcos Jr., gave his speech to Parliament, which was actually the week prior, he referred to Australia as an Asian neighbour, that he considered us to be an Asian neighbour. And did we run a summit as an Asian neighbour would run one? Was there, do you think, a focus on form and respect and conducting things as one of them, the ASEAN nations would, and therefore kind of help that larger, longer-term project of, I don't know, becoming closer in these sort of less harder to kind of concretize but, you know, meaningful ways?
To some degree, yeah. I mean, Australia's going to remain Australia, right? And Australia is not and never will be a Southeast Asian nation. And Australia will never, in my view anyway, be a member of ASEAN, despite the idea being floated politely by Widodo 5 years ago and sort of faintly endorsed in a strange way by Anwar Ibrahim again this time. The reality is, of course, there's a vast gulf between our political culture and the political culture in most Southeast Asian nations, which are themselves very different. They have their own distinct cultural differences between them, of course. But I think the gap is more stark with Australia. All of that said, I think Australia, and in particular the people pulling this together, were very conscious of what makes a successful ASEAN summit, that focus on form, that focus on an appropriate deference shown towards leaders, the focus on space and respect being given to diplomats and officials, and a certain level of formality being injected into proceedings, even when deep down Australian officials might be tempted to roll their eyes slightly. That's not to say, though, that we just tried to run it as a straight facsimile of what you might see in Jakarta, in Singapore, or in Manila. There was, for example, an attempt to inject a little bit more spontaneity into proceedings with the leaders' retreat. Australia was trying to pull away the number of officials present to give the leaders more face time in slightly less structured conversations in the hope that that might allow ideas and bonhomie to flow a little more freely. I'm not sure exactly how successful that was. The fact that the retreat didn't run over time, in fact, it seemed to finish a bit sooner than most of us expected, may hint at the fact that perhaps it wasn't a smashing success, but that's pretty speculative. Look, I think it is safe to say that we tried to give it a slight Australian flavour, but in the end, our main preoccupation was making sure it ran smoothly and making sure that Southeast Asian leaders felt in a broadly familiar and comfortable environment so that Australia has stood the best chance of achieving its aims.
All right, well, let's then talk about the substance. And I'll start with this investment financing facility first, then we'll move on to the declaration. Can you introduce us a little bit to SAFE, the Southeast Asia Investment Financing Facility? How was it sold to everyone at the summit, and what are its chances of being effective in the days and months ahead?
Yeah, well, we won't know for years, right? That's the first thing to say. The proof here will be in the pudding. And it's worth remembering, and more than a few people, including Greg Earle and Susanna Patton and others, have pointed out, the history of Australian diplomacy is littered with Southeast Asian economic strategies of varying success. In particular, the 2018 Sydney, first Australia-ASEAN summit, had its own series of initiatives, more modest in scale than what we're talking about here, but nonetheless, they comprehensively failed to move the dial. And as Greg points out in his piece in The Interpreter recently, there were also efforts in the 90s, of course, under Keating. And none of that has been successful in really actually turbocharging in any meaningful way Australian investment in Southeast Asia. Last I checked, and I haven't double-checked it ahead of this podcast, but it's a great killer stat. Australian direct investment into New Zealand was still higher than it was into Southeast Asia. And I believe that is still the case. On the trade side, things are better, of course, right? Trade is probably still not where it could be, but trade has grown with those economies in Southeast Asia. So we have heard some of this before, and when Albanese declares that Southeast Asia is Australia's future, he's, let's put it this way, not making an original observation. It's one that has been made before. That said, you do get a little bit more of a sense of urgency behind what the government's doing now. And obviously, the announcement that you referred to, the SAIFF, the SAFE, I think is how we're going to have to refer to it, is the signature initiative. Now, SAFE is basically, as I think everyone who's listening will already know, is basically an attempt to bolster Australian investment in the region through the EFA. And the hope is that Australian businesses will be able to draw through Australian government equity and other mechanisms to actually invest more heavily in things like clean energy, like infrastructure and the like. And that by putting all these different financing options on the table, you provide a powerful incentive for business to move forward. $2 billion is what's been allocated through the EFA. Worth noting is that that's still less than has been handed over to the Pacific, where you've got up to $3 billion in loans through the AIFFP. And also worth noting that $2 billion doesn't go nearly so far in Southeast Asia, obviously, as $3 billion does in the Pacific. But nonetheless, it's a potentially, you know, substantial investment. Now, how successful will it be? It's difficult to say. I mean, typically, Australian businesses really cop a lot of heat for being too timid or too conservative to branch out into Southeast Asia. Southeast Asian diplomats are fond of berating Australian super funds and others for being so cautious and for refusing to take any risks, preferring to go to traditional markets, you know, Europe, America, elsewhere, rather than branching out into the slightly more fraught territory of Southeast Asia. And I suspect there's a lot to that criticism. But it is worth noting that it's not necessarily super easy to break into Southeast Asia, or at least it's difficult certainly to break into some parts of Southeast Asia. Getting past local conglomerates is not always straightforward, and businesses have made that point before, particularly when those local conglomerates are pretty well politically connected. Political risk is a real factor. It varies from country to country, but, you know, investing in Singapore is one thing, investing in Cambodia is something very, very different. And it's easy for politicians or taxpayer-funded journalists to berate business for their timidity. We don't have any money on the table here, and we're not answerable to shareholders or to members of the super fund. That said, I think the reason the government is pouring money into this, or at least making money available on the government balance sheet for this, is because there is both a commercial and a strategic imperative to do so. We all know the figures about just how rapidly Southeast Asia is growing, although parts, you know, are still lagging badly. But we all know how critical they're going to be as a market. And we all know that the fact that Australian investment in particular has been lagging is a real sore point amongst Southeast Asian nations. And Southeast Asian elites see it as a sort of concrete illustration of Australian indifference to the region. So there are clear strategic as well as commercial imperatives here that are driving this ambition. Whether it's effective or not, I really just don't know. I'll list a couple of sort of early criticisms that I've heard. The first is that it's possible that there's a risk that Australia ends up subsidising things that might happen anyway, and it would be better to actually do proper sort of climate and development finance instead of something like this. Second criticism, the government isn't just giving money here to this new mechanism. It's also handing another $140 million to P4I, which has already got existing infrastructure partnerships with Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Philippines, a host of other countries. We haven't heard much about partnerships for infrastructure, but there is a murmur that there was a midterm review done on it not that long ago that was not complimentary. I've heard that from two separate sources. So there are question marks potentially hanging over that investment. And then three, it still fundamentally does depend on the will of Australian businesses. Australia, you know, it's not like Beijing. We don't have state-owned enterprises that are sitting there at our beck and call. In the end, it depends on businesses being willing to take the plunge. And for all of the incentives that we're now laying out or the new options that we're laying out to try and smooth that investment, it still requires businesses to actually take the plunge, which might be why Nicholas Moore, the special envoy, spent so much time almost metronomically going through his report and hammering home those key messages again and again and again to business leaders and others throughout the forum. I think I heard him give the same speech at least five or six times. The only way this is going to succeed is if government and others can convince Australian businesses that it is worth the gamble. And we won't know for, you know, another 5 or 10 years at least as to whether these announcements will be successful.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a really important point. If you rely only on the market to solve your problem, the incentives just have not been there, given the risk aversion of Australian businesses and the difficulty of the business environment. And as you say, there are these strategic imperatives that have to be considered alongside the economic opportunities. And I've done some research on this with colleagues at the ANU. Australian economic statecraft inch towards a greater involvement for the state, a greater willingness of the state to intervene in markets. And I'm thinking the financing of Iluka on critical minerals. I'm thinking the purchase of Digicel and the funding of cables in the South Pacific. So what is interesting about all of those solutions is it is the government effectively footing the bill, right? Not trying to involve business. I mean, Digicel with Telstra, yes, Telstra paid a little bit of money, but we paid most of it. The taxpayer paid most of it. And there needs to be a model where it's not just the state doing everything, right, and completely replacing the market. And that's not something that is in our experience, right? We have very much been a card-carrying neoliberal since the 1980s. The markets are the best way of organizing economic activity. Open trade, low trade barriers has been very beneficial for us as a nation, even though it's had economic consequences like hollowing out manufacturing and so forth. By and large, it's been beneficial for Australians. And so we don't have those sinews of the developmental state that you see certainly in China, but also in places like Japan and South Korea, where the government just has more experience and practice in working hand in glove with industry to pursue economic and national objectives at the same time. And so we're going to need some time and some practice and probably some failures to get used to this. But that is not just the economic environment, but the strategic environment that we face. And so I think it's great that we're trying some new things, and practice will make perfect, I think, in this area. Do you have any reactions to that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I can't remember who used the phrase corporatist, but I think that's probably the right word here, right? It's a slightly more corporatist model. And as you say, we haven't really had much practice at it, because for the last 30 years, collectively, we've been pretty convinced it's not necessary. And yet, here we are. Also, I just might point to the cautious response that we've had from the development sector on this. I think it was on Wednesday, ACFID, the Council for International Development, put out its release, and it was pretty lukewarm. and in particular on the climate front. Because, you know, one of the main things the government wants to do here is to drive the clean energy transition and potentially harness not just Australian capital, but also Australian expertise in this space. Now, that sounds great, but as ACFID points out, Export Finance Australia spent a long time before it agreed to stop doing this last year, I think it was, spent a long time ploughing an awful lot of money into, you know, oil, gas, and I think even coal developments. I think it was about $4 billion that ACFID estimated over the decade up to 2021. So there's a bit of caution there amongst at least development professionals about whether EFA is the right mechanism to be doing something like this. Now, maybe this is unfair. Maybe it will work very effectively. And maybe the fact that Southeast Asia is now actually staring the transition in the face in the way that it wasn't, say, back in 2010 or so, means that things will be able to shift and shift quite quickly. But that was another note of caution I heard. And I think it is one worth noting.
Also worth noting at a time when the Australian government is formulating these development partnership plans pursuant to the new international development policy that was released last year. So this is another element that our diplomats and our policymakers are going to have to throw into the mix as they try to work out the optimal development strategy. To what extent is it exclusively led by the government? And how can we incorporate industry, business into this? Because that offers a much greater scope to do things, but is, you know, harder to coordinate, as we've discussed. Let's turn to the declaration. And I'm most interested, I think, on intra-ASEAN tensions on South China Sea and perhaps also on China. Can you just give us your, you know, what you observed, what you heard this week about the degree of unanimity or discord amongst both within ASEAN and between ASEAN and Australia on these issues and how that unfolded in the negotiation of the statement?
Look, I think everyone came to this summit with pretty set expectations about what Southeast Asian leaders were and were not going to be willing to do or say about events in the South China Sea, and those expectations were met. Australia obviously wanted a more forceful statement out of Southeast Asian leaders. They wanted not just the final Melbourne Declaration to carry new language on the South China Sea. For example, a specific reference to the 2016 ruling, the award, that essentially said that much of Beijing's claims to the South China Sea have no validity, but also a specific reference to the militarization of features in the South China Sea. So it wanted that. It also wanted, as far as possible, you know, a pretty free-flowing and frank discussion during those maritime security sessions about, one, the risks that everyone faces as a result of China's behavior in the region, and two, a discussion about leaving the ponderous discussions on the code of conduct to one side, what other mechanisms the region might be able to come up with to try and curb bad behavior and lower tensions. In the end, it landed pretty much exactly where you would have guessed it would. The maritime security session was pretty good. I thought it was very successful. The 1.5 track dialogues around it were great as well, apparently, although I wasn't in there, but I heard some rave reviews of them. Lots of new ideas being thrown around, but at the elite political level, where it matters, the leaders didn't go beyond their set positions. So unsurprisingly, Southeast Asian nations who find the idea of criticizing China over its conduct in the South China Sea were not willing to back the language that Australia put in the zero draft. So all of those references to the 2016 arbitral award and to militarization were taken out. There was a far more generalized call for all countries, that wonderful ASEAN euphemism of choice, all countries to do nothing that might endanger peace or stability. And the nations that you would expect to stay pretty quiet during the maritime security track discussions stayed pretty quiet or just recited the usual talking points. So ASEAN remains pretty divided on this point. Its leaders know that. They are staring this division in the face every day. And they don't yet seem to have any mechanism for breaking that deadlock and coming up with any sort of meaningful response to the events in the South China Sea, which explains why states like Philippines, given the confrontations we're seeing there at the moment, are increasingly, unsurprisingly, turning towards other players for both moral and, in some cases, very practical support. So that's why you see Marcos here spending a lot of time talking to Australia's parliament and vowing not to yield an inch. It's why you've got this intensification of joint patrols, with Australia now joining with the US and the Philippines. It's why you now see Japan and others potentially playing a role. States like the Philippines that are choosing to take a more forceful stance to stand up for themselves have to turn towards other partners. At the moment, ASEAN is not capable of summoning a forceful or useful collective response.
It's not very central then, is what I'm hearing, Stephen, although I appreciate that denying ASEAN centrality on anything is close to blasphemy. But it seems like they are all aware of the dynamics. And so I guess I'm curious, would the Malaysians of the world, and of course we had Prime Minister Anwar quite forcefully defend Malaysia's right to have positive relations with China and to caution against any efforts to try to sort of contain China's rise. Does that mean you get a sense that they are comfortable with the Philippines branching out on its own and looking to work with non-ASEAN partners? Or would they prefer this all got dealt or not got dealt with inside the ASEAN tent?
Look, Darren, I think yes, of course, in a perfect world, all ASEAN nations would prefer that this stayed inside the tent, and they would prefer that the Philippines wasn't calling on the US and others to help them out because it raises the risks of confrontations. But they would also rather that China wasn't doing what it's doing. It's the brute fact of Chinese aggression and militarization in the South China Sea, which sits at the root of all of this, you know, not to point fingers, but it's true. So yes, ASEAN would desperately like to wish this away, but I think they're also realistic. They know that at this point there's just no hope of summoning any sort of meaningful collective response within ASEAN, and so therefore, even though they might desperately wish this problem away, they know it cannot be done, and they know that it's at times going to lead to countries like the Philippines turning to outside partners. Now, the level of blame they apportion for this situation, how much they divvy up that cake between the US and China and others, is difficult to say. It varies from country to country. At the moment, Anwar is cutting it something like 90% in favor of China and 10% in favor of the US, despite the fact that Malaysia has its own deep problems with Chinese incursions on Malaysian territory. But that is just a calculation that they have to make in front of a brute reality, which is China determined to assert absolute control over everything within the nine-dash line. And some Southeast Asian states determined to push back, others simply transfixed by the problem and frozen with indecision.
Well, let's then turn to Gaza, not in the immediate region. We saw Prime Minister Anwar of Malaysia make some fairly strident criticisms of the West and the rules-based order on the grounds of hypocrisy. And not unfairly, I would observe that there is a laser-like attention on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But from the Global South's perspective and many in the region, there is much, much less concern for the plight of the Palestinian people, given Israel's extremely aggressive counter-offensive following the October 7 attacks. How did these dynamics play out at the summit itself, putting Prime Minister Anwar's public criticism, and he did exempt Australia or qualify that criticism, knowing that Australia has called for a ceasefire more recently in a joint statement with Canada and New Zealand. But how are these playing out in Melbourne itself?
Look, Australia knew at the outset that this was going to be a difficult point of contention, and it was. I wondered whether it would get truly bad-tempered inside there. I've only got a couple of readouts from inside the room. Apparently, it did stay very even-tempered, but there was disagreement. More than one Southeast Asian diplomat has told me that it was not an easy negotiation over the language to adopt over Gaza. And unsurprisingly, the final wording had to be ticked off at the very highest level. That's before it even got into the statement. So seniors were being brought into the discussion at a level a little earlier than they might have otherwise because of the sensitivity and the fact that both sides were struggling to reach a common ground. But in the end, I think Australia, broadly speaking, did a pretty good job of neutralising a very difficult and fraught subject. The final language we see on Gaza is exactly the sort of compromise you'd expect. It calls for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. I think the phrase might have been humanitarian pause, but it calls for a ceasefire. It calls with some urgency for more humanitarian relief to be allowed access. It did not include a specific denunciation of what Malaysia has called Israeli crimes, including the use of what Malaysia has described as the use of starvation and the like. Not just Australia pushing back, I'm told, on that, incidentally. Other states like Singapore were also uneasy about including things like that. And it doesn't, as Anwar Ibrahim essentially admitted on Tuesday, it doesn't grapple with some of those basic questions about exactly what is at the root of this awful conflict at the moment. And it does include, it's worth saying, an indirect, essentially an indirect condemnation of Gaza's attack on October 7. They draw a thin gauze over it because the Malaysians have said publicly that they see that attack on October 7 as nothing more than armed resistance. But no other state, I think, around, or very few states in ASEAN saw it that way. So what we've got in the is essentially a fairly awkward but torturously negotiated compromise that everyone can live with.
All right, Stephen, I've just got one more, I guess, big picture angle I wanted to cover, which is to imagine this kind of summit done a year from now when there is once again Donald Trump sitting in the White House. And how that might affect the conduct of the summit and how everyone is thinking about managing the problems of the region, stabilizing the security and the order of the region. And when I view it through that lens, and especially thinking about the most recent on-water incident that happened, I think, on Tuesday of this week with the Chinese Coast Guard using unsafe maneuvers and water cannons on this Philippine resupply vessel, what would happen if the US was completely absent from this conversation, from these issues? How would Australia and the region be managing it? And my guess is that we would be on the phone to Tokyo, maybe to Seoul, Singapore, Manila, obviously, maybe other Southeast Asian nations, and talking and engaging at much more depth than we might otherwise, because we don't have the security blanket, potentially in this scenario, of the United States as a backstop, as a ballast for stability in the region. And so I think about the meticulous preparation and the conduct of this week's summitry as helpful preparation for that world, that we, the only strategy available to Australia, if Donald Trump really does withdraw in a meaningful sense from the world, is just to ramp up our engagement with everybody else. And that, in part, is concrete policy proposals like SIFE and other announceables this week. But in many other ways, it's just the building of ties and relationships that could be called upon when crisis and when trouble strikes in the years ahead. And so the hard diplomatic work of going through these routines and these meetings pays off when things get really hairy, or if they get hairy down the track. It's sort of an observation. I don't really have a question coming out of that, Stephen, but I like the idea of thinking, and I'm hoping that DFAT and indeed the entire region is thinking about the day after, you know, Trump takes office again if he does win in November, and seeing this summit through that lens as really very much a success in helping building those sinews of cooperation that might come very needed in the years ahead. A reaction from you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a really good frame for us to take. And it's absolutely worth thinking about this possibility because, as you know, Trump looks at the very least like a 50-50 bet at the moment. And we don't know for sure whether he's actually going to follow through on his most isolationist instincts, or whether he can be held back as he was by the deep state as he was last time. But there's every chance that he'll have no patience for that this time around. And so I think it is safe to assume that Australia and others are thinking very hard about what a South China Sea contingency might look like without US support there as a security blanket. And I think it would look a lot like what you've described. Incidentally, I think it's also worth thinking about the impact it would have on those states which have, to some degree or another, already accepted a China-centric order in Asia, at the very least. I mean, it's that feeling, as Southeast Asian elites from countries like, you know, Cambodia have made clear previously publicly, it's that feeling that a China-centric order is inevitable that is at least in part driving their behavior. So it's possible that in some Southeast Asian countries, there's a measure of relief, a sense that it would be better to have Trump pulling the US out of this part of the world than another administration keeping the US in, pushing back against Chinese attempts to essentially expand its field of influence and potentially triggering a catastrophic conflict. So some Southeast Asian countries might be quietly relieved by the prospect, but many more others, and larger states in particular, would be very worried indeed by the prospect. Vietnam, Philippines, Singapore, I think would all be very unnerved by that prospect. And I think it is very likely that Philippines in particular is thinking very, very hard about where it looks to for its security. Now, what does it do in the event that America makes it very clear that it's all on its own in the South China Sea? But the military alliance that they've had since 1951, is it? Whatever year it was, I think it was 51, is a worthless piece of paper, or if Trump even tears it up. The question I've got is, does it then begin the furious work of trying to talk to Japan, Australia, South Korea and others about what it might do next, even the Europeans, or does it just fold? Does it decide at that point that the risk is simply too great and we see essentially a quiet withdrawal from all of those disputed features in a recognition of the sheer gap in military capability between the Philippines and China, and a reflection of the fact that they simply don't have confidence that countries like Australia, Japan, Korea have either the will or the capability to do anything at all meaningful in the event of an armed conflict or an armed confrontation in the region. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, assuming China sticks largely to the so-called grey zone tactics that it's used, you could argue what it's doing more recently is not really very grey zone at all, is bordering more on open conflict. But leaving that to one side, maybe Philippines feels it can muddle through with a bit more practical support from more countries in the region. But I think the prospect of a second Trump presidency also has the risk, or also contains the risk, that it catalyzes far more profound shifts in thinking and behavior in ways that we actually perhaps can't entirely predict at this point in time.
All right, Stephen. Well, with the heavy stuff out of the way, before we wrap up, I won't ask for any recommendations. This has been kind of an emergency episode, but is there a little anecdote or tidbit from the last week you'd like to share with us to perhaps end the episode on a bit of a lighter note?
Look, a couple of little tidbits, just small ones, nothing too scandalizing or scandalous. But the great thing about summits like this, of course, is that you get an opportunity to see diplomacy in all its glory, in particular multilateral diplomacy in all its glory, up very close and personal. One of the favourite moments I had is when I overheard a bunch of Australians, I won't say the agency, but a bunch of Australians complaining about the fact that it was impossible to nudge Laos as the co-partner, or as the co-chair rather, of this entire meeting, to do anything public whatsoever. There was certainly no question that Laos was going to take any sort of questions at the final press conference, despite the fact that that is typically what happens at the end of Australia-ASEAN summits. Well, there's been two. It happened last time when Turnbull and Lee Hsien Loong stood up. So I guess it's not fair to call it a precedent. But nonetheless, there was not a chance that Laos was going to be willing to do that. Just another little reminder of just the sharp differences in political culture and assumptions that you often encounter when you have to deal with Southeast Asia. And then the second observation I'll make is that koala diplomacy may or may not be hopelessly tired. It may or may not be terribly hypocritical. Phil Khoury, you might have seen, the politics editor of the Financial Review, launched a furious diatribe on Twitter accusing governments of being total hypocrites for dragging out the poor koalas whilst we're still cutting down their native habitat at a rate of knots. But whether or not it is hypocritical and predictable, it is astonishingly still very effective. It was extraordinary to see all of the foreign journalists or the Southeast Asian journalists flock to the koala when it was brought into the media centre. And it was also just fascinating to watch all of the Southeast Asian leaders when they had the obligatory pat and cuddle session with a koala at Government House ahead of the meeting. Lee Hsien Loong's face was broken into the most genuine smile that I have seen on it for many, many years. One or two leaders were perhaps a little bit awkward, but most of them just seemed genuinely excited by the delight of having the opportunity to give a koala a pat. It always does my brain in because these creatures, precious as they are, seem so unremarkable to me. And I guess that there's something that's so deeply predictable about pulling them out. And, you know, I think we talk a lot about projecting a modern image of Australia, and yet we keep on turning back time and time again to the hoary, dependable favourites of the sort of 80s, vaguely Crocodile Dundee inflected sort of version of public diplomacy. But all of that said, the picture still got splashed all over the media, all throughout Southeast Asia. The leaders were delighted. So it may be bone-tinglingly predictable, but it seems to work.
Well, on that note, Stephen, thank you once again for joining us. That was really informative, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
No worries, Darren. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Well, that's all for today's episode of Australia in the World. I thank Walter Carnaghi for research and audio editing, and of course, Rory Stenning for composing our theme music. We will talk to you again soon.